This is Phil Farron, and I'm driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 211, I think. It's been a fascinating week. The good news is there's plenty of work to do, so it's always nice when you're a consultant and people keep saying, and you could do this, and could you do this, and could you go, sure. It's all just billable hours to me, so that's going fine. I do have about a couple of hours of work to do tomorrow to get up to my target. Here recently, I may have mentioned this before. This year is my 25th wedding anniversary with my wife, and we've been discussing where we're going to go and those kind of things. And there's a couple of months where I'm going to have a fifth week in the month, and so I've told my wife I'll go ahead and work those 5 weeks, and then we'll just take that money and use it for having a little vacation. So trying to be really conscientious about hitting my mark, which is supposed to be 34 hours a week, you know, bang, 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 hit those every week. So I'm down about an hour and 45 minutes, and there's part of the reason for that is what I'm going to talk about today, which is a fascinating topic. Get to that in a minute. I have been doing my read-through on Farforth Fables 2, Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flayer, and it's going fine. It actually is in a little rougher shape than normal, but that's because I powered through it. You know, I wanted to keep myself to a schedule. And so there were several spots in it when I got done with a chapter and was like, that's good enough. I have it roughed in. I know where that's going. So I'm kind of paying that for that a little bit now, because now I have to go back and, you know, restructure and actually get it worked into shape. But I'm almost through my first read-through on it, and I think it's going to be fine. There's some cute stuff in it. There's some just fun, cute stuff in it. And there's a good message, I think, in it, which is part of what I'm going to be talking about today as well. So, in other news, baby boy is growing, the new grand boy, who came last week. That boy, he likes to eat. I can tell you that. My wife had my daughter and son-in-law and the family down a couple of nights this week to feed, because they're just too, you know, they're next door. They're like 300 feet away from us in the woods. And so we had them come down, and my wife cooked to give them a little reprieve from that necessary part of life. And my daughter had gone in one of our bedrooms to nurse Asher William, is his name. She came out and put him down, and he slept a little bit. I don't think he slept for over an hour. Kind of woke back up. He was ready to eat again. So the kids were saying, wow, you know, I'm trying to get this kid into a schedule. And I said, well, you've got all that data that from the app that Lizzie used last time. I said, have you gone and checked that? And they said, no, we haven't done that yet. So the benefits of data. Lizzie was very good about recording when he ate and, you know, how long he nursed for and all that kind of stuff with her first child. And so she had that data. They went back and checked it. And sure enough, you know, they were having the same kinds of things. So they're trying to get Asher into a schedule and trying to get him to where he sleeps a little bit at night, as opposed to just nodding off and then wanting to eat again. So they're in that whole process, and it's a fascinating thing. Life, it's a fascinating thing. But this week, and actually this week and last week, I can't remember if I mentioned it last week. Bitcoin, I think maybe I mentioned it. Did I mention it last week? I should go back and listen to some of these podcasts or keep my notes. Anyways, I've been tracking Bitcoin now for 3 or 4 weeks and trying to work my way through, you know, jump through the hoops to actually get to the place where I could buy something. Today, I actually put in the order, the money, or the bank wire order to move some funds up so that I can get them into one of the exchanges. It's going to be really interesting to see if that really works. I went to my credit union and brought them the information for the actual money order, or for the actual wire transfer, and it's this big, long string of numbers and stuff. And so I had the piece of paper. I also brought with me a flash drive that had the digital copy. This is interesting. Looks like there's a truck here that didn't quite make the tight corner, and now he's trying to negotiate through, but hey, he's making it. So I brought the file on a digital flash drive so they could just copy and paste the numbers. So I asked them how we did this, and they said, well, you have to fill out this form. So here I am copying from my printed copy all this gargantuan numbers onto this form. And I said, well, I have a digital copy here. And they said, oh, well, they're going to need the form because they're going to copy it onto another form. It's like, oh, are you kidding? So... So the data guy in me was just thinking, wow, there is no way this is going to work. But we'll see. We'll see. So I'm close. I'm close to being ready to transfer this thing. And it's been very interesting because I did a lot of research on Bitcoin, been watching it. And in the time that I had been watching it, it had gone from like $70 a Bitcoin to $100 a Bitcoin, to $150 a Bitcoin, to $200 a Bitcoin, to $250 a Bitcoin. I had already decided, okay, you know, that's it. If I have to go in at $250, I'm going in at $250 because as long as people keep demanding higher prices for these, it's going to go up because Bitcoins have no intrinsic value whatsoever. It is a cryptocurrency. It's really a fascinating thing. And pardon me if I'm repeating myself because I can't remember what I talked about last week. So let me just put it out there for you. Bitcoin was started in 2008, probably as a reaction against all the banking weirdness in 2008, 2009. It is open source, which means that the mechanism for doing all this, all the source code is out there for people to review. It uses cryptology and high-level encryptions to specify a standard whereby machines, by hashing these mathematical algorithms, can create blocks, they're called. And a block has a very specific hash value that is created with a mathematical formula that is fairly intensive to solve. And the level of intensity, the level of difficulty for solving that formula can be directly controlled by specifying what the resulting hash value, what the characteristics that the resulting hash values should have in order to qualify as the hash value for a block. And it has to do something with a string of zeros in it. So the more zeros in a row that you have, the more difficulty, I guess, it is to generate one of these things. I guess. I'm a little bit fuzzy on some of these things. So what this means is that anybody who wants to can set up, it's called a mining rig, can set up a mining rig and can begin trying to generate these blocks. Now, the thing about generating one of these blocks is they are necessary for the continued functioning of Bitcoin because that's where you store transactions of Bitcoin. And If you generate one of these blocks and you add it to the global chain, which there's a process for doing that, and it is recognized globally as something that you've contributed, you get bitcoins. So that's why it's called mining. You can actually create these bitcoins yourself. The difficulty is high enough now on creating these blocks that it seems like I read somewhere that if you set up your own rig, you might be able to expect to create a block and get awarded 25 bitcoins in 2 years. So there are these mining pools where everybody puts their processing power together and all the machines work together, and then you generate one of these blocks and ta-da, you know, you get a portion of those bitcoins. As of yesterday, and I didn't check today, they were generating 6, 8, 10 blocks an hour, somewhere around that, by all of these thousands of machines that are working on this problem. It's really fascinating. So, the people who earn these bitcoins then can just keep them for themselves, or they can transfer them from one wallet to another. There is no centralized bank involved in this whatsoever. The transfers of bitcoins from one wallet to another are verified by the peer-to-peer network. There is no single server that actually verifies all this stuff. It's all done by multiple servers voting to verify. So you can't just take down one computer and cause a crash on Bitcoin, theoretically. So it's really very fascinating. Bitcoin is set up to be a limited currency, much like the old gold standard was. And economists will tell you that it's non-workable because of that. That you have to be able to print as much currency as you want. And that's what banks do. There are interesting libertarian viewpoints to all of that. One of them is, there's a saying that it is no coincidence that a century of war directly coincided to a century of centralized banking. So they would say that this idea of using centralized banking and just printing all the money you want is one of the components that leads to war, which is kind of an interesting viewpoint. Anyways, or maybe just that centralized banking leads to centralized massive wars, which is pretty interesting. Anyways, so Bitcoin is really set up on the old model, like the gold standard, that your currency itself can become more valuable because it's rare and more people want it. So supposedly there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins in existence, and they're over 11 million now. And they started out having zero value because they have no intrinsic value. It's all just cryptology. It's all just encryption schemes and this huge blockchain that's recording who owns these bitcoins, who has been awarded these bitcoins, and who sent them to whom. And if, for instance, they are in a wallet, and the wallets are all secured with private keys that you hold. You have a wallet, you have a private key. Anybody who can get that private key and knows your wallet address can take money out of your wallet. It's just like cash. And once it's been transferred, you can't really get it back. It's like, well, that's too bad. So there have been stories of spectacular thievery where someone hacked somebody else's machine that had 25,000 bitcoins on it, and they just transferred it out of his wallet, and that was the end of that. So this is very interesting. The non-regulated, completely outside of any government structure nature of this thing is really fascinating. I've been watching it, and I've been wanting to get into this game just to have some play money to kick around with in it. And I've been trying to. You gotta jump through a bunch of hoops at this point still to get in this game. It's not easy to get in this game. And there are some supposedly easy ways, but everybody was so overwhelmed because people were scrambling trying to get into this that the fees that you would have to pay for the fast ways to get into it, I was just thinking, I don't want to pay those fees. I just don't want to pay those fees. So I eventually found and researched a place called Aram Exchange or something like that. Apparently it's in Poland, which is fine. I did some just web snooping about it, and they seemed to have a good reputation. They were fine, blah, 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 blah. But the only way that you could do a wire transfer to them, you could use e-currencies, but of course, in order to get into those e-currencies, you basically had to do things. The only way you could do a wire transfer directly into them is if you were verified. You had to be verified. And that meant you had to give them your driver's license. You had to give them, you know, something to prove that was your address. Okay, well, fine. I've done that type of thing before when I bought silver. So, yeah, I know about those things. So I went ahead this last Saturday because Bitcoin just kept going up. And because there is no intrinsic value on Bitcoins, it's just whatever we all decide it is at the moment. And I was watching the number of Bitcoins that were available for sale and the number of demand, and there was a high demand. I mean, everybody was in this mania phase, and I use the term was in this mania phase about Bitcoin. And Bitcoin had these mania phases before because it started out as zero. And then it got to be worth pennies, and then it got up to about $30. Well, the people who started out at pennies, that's a pretty good return. And then it crashed down to $2. There was some problem. Somebody got hacked somewhere, and everybody lost confidence and crashed down to $2. And then it worked its way back up to $30, $40. And then the big Cyprus thing hit several weeks ago, and it had been on a tear since then. It had gone from 30 to 50 to 70 to 100 to 150 to 200 to 250. As of yesterday, it had hit 266. And I had just resolved myself that I actually was going to buy it at 275 if I had to, or 300. Because I didn't see, if the demand kept being there, how it could go down. There's no reason for it not to go to 400 or 1,000 or even 10,000. It all is just demand because it has no intrinsic value. So, okay, fine. So yesterday, I've been waiting for them to give me a verified account on RX Exchange. I wrote them yesterday, you know, actually took a half an hour off work to write them, to do some research, to see if there was any way else I could get stuff in. And I confirmed to myself that RX Exchange, Aram Exchange, I can't remember what it's called, really looked like my best option. I was already in process. I thought, well, okay, I'm just going to wait. And then ping, here comes in the email, and they say, yes, you're ready to go. I'm like, woohoo! You know, so I put in my first thing and try to put in my order for doing the money order so I could get it in last night. And I have to have my banking information. It's like, rats. Okay, never mind. So I went ahead and waited till last night, put it through, got my paperwork. But I noticed yesterday that when I went out there and I was checking to see what the Bitcoin prices were, and I had to take off time from work to do that too because they don't pay me to look at Bitcoin. So when I was doing that, it was long enough that I hit a 15-minute block, and so I just went, okay, well, we're not charging them for this. So I diddled away like 45 minutes yesterday doing this stuff that I didn't charge my company for, that I consult with. And I noticed in the afternoon, I went out there, and it had been like 266, and I take a look at it, and it says 170. And I'm like, what? 170? So I go and I look at the charts. Sure enough, Bitcoin has had this huge crash, and it's gone from 266 down to 105. And then it started climbing its way back. Apparently, what happened, I'm getting my mail. Apparently what happened is it got up to 266 and people have just been piling on trying to buy this stuff. And they've been executing more and 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 more trades. And they've done enough trades going that they were overloading the system. And they said that Mt. Gox, mtgox.com, they said they were actually going to have to close trading for a couple of hours to bring some more servers online because they'd just been getting pounded with trades. I don't know if it was because of that, because things were slowing down, people were getting nervous. But somebody decided, okay, that's it, it's time to get out. And quite a few people decided, okay, that's it, it's time to get out. And so they all started selling, and sure enough, wham, 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 and there it goes. That's called the bubble. I'm backing into my garage. So it just started going, bah, 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 bah. And it got all the way down to 105 until it finally sucked up all of the people who were wanting, that were panicking and wanting to sell and get it out. And then by the time it got down to that point, then the people that were left were like, I'm not selling for under that. There's no point. And then it started shoring back up. So then it made it up to 170. And then it's been drifting. Mt. Gox at this point is like at $125 a Bitcoin, but there are a couple other U.S. exchanges that are actually down in the 60s. And it's really interesting because on Mt. Gox, you can see charts that show how many bids there are in of what people are willing to buy Bitcoins for, and then you can see how many asks there are for what people are willing to sell Bitcoin for. And there's this huge gap in the middle, right around 120. And the last I checked, it had been over 2 hours since a trade had gotten through. It's like everybody's staring everybody else down. It's so fascinating. But in the process of all that this week, and the fact that I actually walked away from 3/4 of an hour of earnings to check this stuff, I had to admit to myself again that Bitcoin had caught my fascination and caught my interest, and really the reason that it had, if I was honest with myself, was because I saw in Bitcoin the option. I saw in Bitcoin the possibility of relieving some of the uncertainty of life. I could imagine what would it be like if I had bought Bitcoin when it was pennies. And now it's 266. I could have retired. Just the thought of that. It's like thinking about the lottery. It's the same thing. Just the thought of that. It's like, oh. You know, the flesh is down there going, oh, wouldn't that have been good? You need to get in now. You need to get in now. It's really fascinating. Because the underlying assumption is that if you could just have money, you could solve the uncertainty problem in your life. But the problem with just having money is that you always think I need more money. And you always start worrying about losing your money. So just having money isn't really the answer to uncertainty. And as I'm talking about in Farforth Fables, I think the real answer to uncertainty is not to try to solve uncertainty, but more to celebrate it and to say, yeah, you bet, I have no idea what's going to be happening in the future. That's the way the system is set up. But what I can do is I can live in this moment. I can live in relationship in this moment and make the most of my relationships in this moment. That's the first thing I think we can do. And I've actually, the great thing about writing is you get a chance to work some things out. And I've actually been trying to do that more, even more, in the relationships that I'm in. Just really enjoy the moment in my relationships. And beyond that, I think there is something else that we can do that certainly helps us with the uncertainty. And I'm going to do something that I don't think I've ever done before on the podcast. I'm actually going to record another podcast tomorrow. At least I'm going to try. I have to take my dad, who is 90, to the hospital tomorrow to get some blood tests done. And then next week, I have to take him to a doctor's appointment. And I think tomorrow, I'm going to bring the recorder along. And I'm going to record episode 212 tomorrow with my dad, because I want to specifically talk about the second approach to dealing with uncertainty with him. Because I've watched him use that second approach for as long as I can remember, both he and my mom. And so I think he can speak with some authority if he will talk with me as we go down tomorrow. So that will be next week's podcast. But to come back and recap this week's, I really think that part of the flesh's intention with shining a flashlight on uncertainty is not to help us prepare for the uncertainty, but it is simply to keep us tied up in mental energy of reflecting on the uncertainty so that we miss the wonderful moments that are transpiring in our lives right now. And that if we would just enjoy those, we would find that our anxiety over the future and over the uncertainty of our lives would diminish, because we would find that joy that there is in just living in the moment. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.